this is Danette Gorman from HelpSyriasKids.org. We are connecting the Hudson community with a Syrian refugee camp in Katarmaya, Lebanon. You're listening to WGXC ACRA.
Toronto's Park Rabbit Trio bridges the divide between acoustic and electronic keyboards with music that spans across genres, and we'll sample their pan-stylistic sound on the next Deep Threes. Plus music from A&D, CKZ, and Freddie Hubbard. Deep Threes. Where will the music take you?
Tune in to Deep Threes after the noon news on Monday at WGXC 90.7 FM.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Mid-Hudson Cable, serving Columbia, Greene, and Southern Albany counties with digital cable, high-speed internet, and cable phone services for homes and businesses since 1971. Mid-Hudson Cable, all the right connections on the web at mhcable.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Bob Wills Architecture of Rhinecliff, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. Become a WGXC sustaining supporter today. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
From the WGXC Newsroom, this is the WGXC Daily News. I'm Philip Grant. While three more deaths announced in Columbia County February 4th is certainly not good news, the number of new COVID-19 cases locally is not currently climbing like it was a few weeks ago. Thursday, there were 21 new coronavirus cases announced in Columbia County and 16 new cases in Greene County. Nationally, there is also good and bad news as vaccine supplies increase, but new variants that are more transmittable and maybe deadlier are spreading. The national government is now mandating masks on public transportation and in federal buildings, but people are sure to mingle more in public with upcoming holidays after staying inside for winter storms and bitter cold in many parts of the country. In Ulster County, there is also good and bad news. Ulster County Executive Pat Ryan said February 4th that his county has received 6,800 doses of COVID vaccine over the past 4 weeks, but that more than 30,000 people have signed up to get the shots. Ulster County reported 2 more deaths and 54 new positive tests on February 5th. Dutchess County reported 3 more deaths and 34 more cases. Rensselaer County announced 61 new COVID-19 cases and 1 more death February 5th. And Albany County had 155 new cases and 2 more deaths. Amanda Fries is reporting for the Times Union. Reporters covering the state capitol are calling on Governor Andrew M. Cuomo to consider equity when picking which journalist gets to ask questions during his virtual news conferences, including giving more transparency and accessibility to the press. The Legislative Correspondents Association, or LCA, is made up of dozens of reporters and editors from various news outlets. The association sent the letter February 1st, requesting the governor allow reporters to ask at least one follow-up question, diversify which reporters are selected for questioning by taking into account race, ethnicity, gender, and age, and alert news outlets at least 2 hours in advance of his public appearances. Because of the coronavirus pandemic, the governor shifted his briefings to conference calls as well as the online platform Zoom, but who gets picked to ask a question and their ability to ask follow-up questions for clarity have plagued reporters for months. Some reporters described that despite taking part in dozens of briefings and requesting to ask a question, they are passed over for reporters who Cuomo and his executive team appear to favor. In a letter, LCA reporters recommended Cuomo adopt a practice similar to New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio's virtual press conferences, where a variety of reporters are called on and news outlets are guaranteed one question per week. Richard Azzopardi, Cuomo's spokesman, and others in Cuomo's office have declined to say specifically who determines which reporters are called on, other than to say, and I quote, a lot of us, end quote, when asked if it's members of the governor's communications team. Read the full story in the Times Union. Patricia Doxey is reporting for the Daily Freeman. Deputy Ulster County Executive Anna Markowitz walked members of the County Legislature Public Safety and Law Enforcement Committee through a criminal justice reform plan that administration officials say will help end mass incarceration countywide, improve police oversight and accountability, address systemic racial bias, and heal relationships between the county sheriff's office and residents. The plan, developed by the Ulster County Criminal Justice and Reform Commission, is made up of 9 initiatives, including measures to address police accountability, expand restorative justice programs, and better address how law enforcement interacts with people suffering from mental health and addiction issues. Markowitz said County Executive Pat Ryan will ask the legislature to approve the plan on March 16th. Public Safety and Law Enforcement Committee Chairperson Eve Walter said resolutions implementing elements of the plan that require legislative approval will be brought to the legislature individually. Legislator John Perrett said that while the plan addresses issues including police interactions with the public and criminal justice system reforms for the accused, it does little to address public safety. The Boyceville Democrat also criticized the plan for recommending strategies to help those struggling with opioid addiction, but not for prevention and education programs that could help people from becoming addicted. Local government statewide must pass a local law enacting police reforms by April 1st. And you can read the full story in the Daily Freeman. Pete DeMola is reporting for the Times Union. An Albany man has been charged in connection with a phone call that led to 2 Bethlehem area schools being placed in lockout status the afternoon of Wednesday, February 3rd. Police said Michael L. Litz, Jr., 35, was charged with making a terroristic threat and aggravated harassment as a hate crime, both felonies. Litz was arraigned in Bethlehem Town Court and released under the supervision of Albany County Probation, police said. Litz was under probation and taken to the Albany County Jail for allegedly violating the conditions of his probation, where he remained as of Thursday afternoon, according to jail officials. Just before 2 p.m. on Wednesday, a call came to St. Thomas the Apostle School in Delmar from an unknown man who stated to the school employee, and I quote, all God's children are going to pay. I tried to talk to your expletive omitted priest, end quote. The man then hung up. School officials notified the police and the St. Thomas School and the Bethlehem Central Middle School were put in lockdown status as a precaution. Read the full story in the Times Union. And that wraps up the WGXC Daily News. For local weather reports, public meetings, community information, or COVID-19 updates, visit our website at WGXC.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a nice weekend.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Friday, February 5th. We got 26 in Wemple and 29 in Ankrum this morning, and temperatures are pretty even across the board, even up on the mountain. Those will rise to a high of 38 at 2 p.m. And that's going to turn the light morning snow into rain that will finish by 4 p.m. A half inch of accumulation is expected. Overnight temperatures fall to 22 at dawn tomorrow. Saturday will be dry with a light breeze and a high of 34. Sunday, an inch of snow is expected to fall through the day. The high will be 33. Today's tide schedule is low at 3:08 a.m., high at 8:57 a.m., low again at 4 p.m., and high again at 9:19 p.m. Sunset today will be at 5 p.m., and sunrise tomorrow will be at 7 a.m. Those are all on the dot. Looking way up, we are expecting the Earth to pass through the heliospheric current sheet and could trigger magnetic storms late tomorrow. Solar wind speed is currently 422 kilometers per second at 3.7 protons per milliliter. The 24-hour predicted KP index is 3, quiet. The current sunspot number is 0. And this has been the Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Michael Gassman of Arlington, Virginia. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about Creative Community Radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to wgxc.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
Info, music, signals, news, fun and frolic, and emergency instructions.
90.7 FM, WGXC.
Tune into WGXC all day for all kinds of creative community entertainment information and more. Amelia Ortez, Lena Ruiz, AJ Pernetti, and Emily Shimidis are on the Bound by Books show from the Hudson Area Library at 7 p.m. with local youth talking about the books they're reading. Then at 8 p.m. it's time for relationship advice, matchmaking, and more from Anya Kanevskaya and Amanda Lees on Donna and Honey's Love Motel. And at 10 p.m., a brand new show from Guy Welchek debuts on the radio at WGXC. Champ Sound is an open format mix show focusing on Jersey Club techno, house, and experimental genres. Tune in to Champ Sound 10 p.m. tonight on the radio at WGXC.org.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times. The House removed controversial freshman Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene of her committee assignments late yesterday. The Georgia Republican faced backlash over violent and racist rhetoric and her embrace of conspiracy theories. Before the vote, Taylor Greene said she was swayed by false online information.
I also want to tell you 9/11 absolutely happened. I definitely want to tell you I do not believe that it's fake.
Parties sometimes strip assignments from their members like Republicans did to Iowa's Steve King in 2019. But it's a first in modern times for another party to do so, although 12 Republicans joined the Democrats to remove her from both the House Education, Labor, and the Budget Committees. The latest on former President Donald Trump's impeachment trial. His lawyers denied a request from House impeachment managers for Trump to voluntarily testify. The request noted that refusal to testify under oath could count against him at trial. The Senate could also use the subpoena. Earlier, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said she has faith in the case.
I have great confidence in them, and we'll see. We'll see if it's going to be a Senate of courage or cowardice.
Meanwhile, new polls from Quinnipiac and Marist show more Americans favor conviction than acquittal. Fox News and some of Trump's closest allies are defendants in a new $2.7 billion lawsuit filed by electronic voting systems maker Smartmatic for allegedly perpetuating false claims that the election was fraudulent. On foreign policy, President Joe Biden announced the end of U.S. support for Saudi-led operations in Yemen. Biden also called on Burma's military to end its government coup and release detainees.
We will work with our partners to support restoration of democracy and the rule of law and impose consequences on those responsible.
And the U.S. and Russia have agreed to extend the START Treaty, the bilateral pact that limits nuclear arms. In the Senate, it's called the Votorama process and started last night. It allows for a flurry of amendments to slow down or change a budget resolution during debate. The resolution allows President Biden's COVID relief bill to pass without GOP approval. Here's a reaction from Republican Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell.
Democrats in Congress are plowing ahead. They're using this phony budget to set the table to ram through their $1.9 trillion rough draft.
But a bipartisan group of more than 400 mayors this week said the relief plan is long overdue. Speaking of relief, Representative Ilhan Omar of Minnesota joined other congressional Democrats yesterday to introduce a student debt resolution.
We are taking a needed action to tackle the student loan debt crisis by using executive authority under the Higher Education Act to cancel up to $50,000 in student debt for federal loan borrowers.
The White House says it will consider taking executive action, but would welcome a bill from Congress. On day one, Biden signed an executive order pausing federal student loan payments. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
Next, we hear excerpts from two WGXC shows, the Counterspin Show and the Radio Survivor Show, both talking about the Prometheus versus the FCC Supreme Court case. The Federal Communications Commission went before the Supreme Court against the Prometheus Radio Project from Philadelphia, January 19th. First, let's hear from the Counterspin Show about that case, as they talk to Hannah Sassaman about that case.
A big part of modern media criticism involves illustrating the impact of corporate ownership and sponsorship on the media we see, including the effect of concentration of ownership. More and more radio and TV stations in fewer hands, in devastating local media and narrowing the range of voices and perspectives media reflect overall. If the influence of media's mega corporate control is evident in Branch and Leaf, the hidden soil, as it were, is the policy that determines who gets to own outlets. A conversation about representation or diversity can only go so far without hitting that bedrock. That recognition is part of what's behind Prometheus Radio Project versus FCC, in which the federal agency tasked with protecting the public interest once again asks the court for support in jettisoning it. Here to no doubt put a finer point on it is Hannah Sassaman, a former organizer with Prometheus Radio Project. She's now policy director at Movement Alliance Project, also a party to this Supreme Court case. She joins us by phone from Philadelphia. Welcome back to Counterspin, Hannah Sassaman.
Thank you so much.
Well, listeners know that media owners have been fighting for decades to get rid of the rules that restricted their ability to grow to a certain share of the market or to own multiple outlets in one city. And they've had some success, unfortunately, with a pretty captured FCC. What is the FCC trying to do here? And have they come up with some new argument this time around, or is it the same kind of trust in the market and all will be well?
Sure, that's a great question. So if you go all the way back to 1996, under the then Bill Clinton Federal Communications Commission in Congress, there was a law that was passed called the Telecom Act of 1996, and that went in and said, all right, in markets, in media markets all over the country, whether you live in Rochester, New York, or Tulsa, Oklahoma, or San Antonio, Texas, we're going to make it so just a handful of companies, like maybe one newspaper, for example, could own both that local daily paper as well as a handful of radio stations, a television station. And that's the process, as you just described, of media consolidation, meaning that we have fewer and fewer owners owning outlets. Now, the commission under that Telecom Act of 96 is required to analyze whether or not relaxing media ownership impacts the number of women's voices, women's owned stations, and the number of minority-owned stations, so black and brown stations around the country or outlets around the country. Now, what the FCC has not done is actually its homework. So every 4 years, they go around and they say that they've looked around and examined ownership, and they say, it's fine, don't worry about it, letting companies own more stations, own more outlets in these markets won't impact that racial and gender diversity. But then groups like mine, groups like Prometheus Radio, and other organizations around the country, like represented by truly dogged public interest lawyers, said, hold up, you haven't done your work. You haven't actually proven that it hasn't hurt these markets. And it's just absolutely evident if you go around the country that we've seen the impacts of consolidation as it's already progressed on squashing diverse voices and really lifting up primarily conservative ones. If you take a look, for example, at Sinclair Broadcasting, which is one of the largest owners of broadcast television outlets in the United States, those were companies that literally were promoting during this pandemic conspiracy theories. They were taking rhetoric coming out of the Trump administration and creating editorial content and distributing it and parroting it around the country. So that was absolutely a really major cause in an America where 90% of our community listens to broadcast media at least every week. It's not just all online. It was a major cause of the polarization that's led to some of the biggest upsets in American democracy that we've ever seen. So the Prometheus versus the FCC case was decided multiple times in what's called the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, where Prometheus is headquartered, where my organization, Movement Alliance Project, is headquartered. And the court said, yes, we don't think the FCC has done its homework. And it's gone back and told the FCC to actually show this time whether or not it impacted the diversity it is required to protect. And so the government appealed that decision to the Supreme Court. We had our arguments just, you know, a couple weeks ago, and we'll wait to see what the Supreme Court decides. That's where we're at.
Sassaman was referring to the Sinclair television stations. They include the CBS and the CW stations in Albany that often play the propaganda Sassaman was discussing there. Next, we hear Minnesota University Professor Christopher Terry and his take with the Radio Survivor Show on the case before the Supreme Court.
We welcome back to the program a dear friend of the program, Professor Christopher Terry from the University of Minnesota.
Always great to be here.
The Federal Communications Commission was in front of the Supreme Court on the 19th of January as part of this long-standing case, FCC v. Prometheus Radio Project. Prometheus is stands in for a group of public interest organizations who have sued the FCC regarding its regulation of ownership in the media. And a particular issue in this case is how is the effect of ownership regulations on the ownership of media, radio and television in particular, by women and minorities. The case has been sitting in the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, which is actually out of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, for well over a decade, going on two decades now. And the FCC appealed this to the Supreme Court. And you know, in short, effectively, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals keeps telling the FCC, you know, you want to change the rules, or mostly you want to loosen the ownership regulations, allow single companies to own even more television stations or possibly more radio stations. But you don't provide research that seems to adequately show why this is in the public interest, or that that it will create greater diversity, or that it will have really things that are that will be effective for democracy, shall we say, versus just only help to line the pockets of the existing owners. And the FCC is trying to get out of this kind of wormhole it's gotten itself into of sort of making these updates. You know, the court giving guidance, you need to do this, you need to do this, and them sort of failing their homework for all intents and purposes. So the big day was on the 19th with the with FCC v. Prometheus in front of the Supreme Court. What was the oral arguments, right? This is oral arguments. This is the opportunity for the FCC to present its best case, as well as the opponents under Prometheus to present their best case. What were the big things that came up on that day?
Well, so the Prometheus case, and we've talked about it several times over the years that we've been together. And I think the first time I came on, that's what we actually talked about. And we've talked about it several times since. So on the 19th, what happened was that you have actually three different parties that pled a case in front of the Supreme Court. You had the FCC, you had the NAB, who was sort of on the side of the FCC.
The National Association of Broadcasters, the largest broadcast lobby in the United States.
Right. They sort of agree with the FCC, but not entirely. And it was actually two cases that were merged into one case. So that's sort of on one side. And then on the other side, you have the Prometheus group, which is the lead respondent, but represents a large and relatively diverse group of what have been known as the citizen petitioners in these cases. So the FCC goes first, and the FCC's sort of central argument is that the Third Circuit has gone beyond the authority granted to courts when they review administrative agency decisions. unlike at the appellate level in the Third Circuit where this case usually gets argued, it wasn't an FCC lawyer arguing it. It was the deputy solicitor general arguing on behalf of the government. And frankly, I didn't think his argument was very good. But what was notable about it is he made a relatively straightforward FCC argument that the FCC has tried to solve these problems many times, but they just can't get the Third Circuit on board, and that the agency believes that the Third Circuit has exceeded its authority here and that they would really like some form of relief. And although there have been several press reports that suggest that the justices were on board with that, that really wasn't my read at all. In fact, I thought the justices asked some really pointed questions of the FCC during the FCC's time. And it was they were direct and very specific. Now,
so what were some of those questions? What were they kind of?
I'm getting there. So just for a little, for the simple sake of discussion, there's really two cases when you take the Prometheus cases to the Supreme Court. There's the issues that are in the Prometheus case, and then there's the judicial practice issues, how courts are interacting with administrative agencies. There were a lot of people who thought the Supreme Court took this case on the governmental and judicial practice angle. Justice Kavanaugh, Justice Gorsuch, they are absolutely involved in questions on that front. There's a lot of movement in the legal community to move that way. But that wasn't what the questions were actually really. There was a couple of them, but there was more questions about whether or not the FCC had met the obligations on this minority ownership issue. So you have the media ownership issue, which is how the FCC is doing in reviewing the rules that were handed to them in the 1996 Telecommunications Act. And then there's a secondary issue about how those decisions are affecting the ownership of stations by women and minorities, which is a direct diversity issue. And to be fair, the FCC got asked some really pointed questions about the minority ownership issue. And I'm frankly kind of surprised about that. One of the justices that really surprised me was Justice Barrett. She asked a couple of really direct questions on this diversity issue.
Justice Barrett, the newest member of the Supreme Court.
Newest member. You know, the part of the reason that surprised me is because she hasn't been on the court long enough to get a feel on how she asked questions. But notably, Justice Thomas asked a couple questions of the FCC, which if you know anything about the Supreme Court, Justice Thomas doesn't talk very often. Justice Thomas has, to his credit, been very interested in broadcast regulation going back. And the last major broadcast regulation case that went to the Supreme Court was over broadcast indecency back in 2012. So there really hasn't been a bunch of cases that dealt with broadcasting's standards of review in the court for, you know, the better part of a decade now. So then the NAB attorney went up. Her name is Helgi Walker, and she is a very impressive attorney. Let me just say that. Although I don't subscribe to the ideas that she's presenting, she's very impressive. She was very impressive at the Third Circuit. She was very impressive this week, or last week in the oral argument. And her argument is different than the FCC's argument. Her argument is more on that administrative law aspect. The NAB's position is that the statute, by that I mean the 1996 Telecommunications Act and specifically Section 202H, which is sort of the source of all of this dispute, doesn't require the FCC to consider the public interest or things like minority ownership, except when they affect competition. So competition is the most important mechanism that the FCC is responsible for as a result of the powers given to the agency by Congress. And her argument is very similar to the argument that she made at the Third Circuit the last go-round, where the broadcasters are basically pinned in place by this. Whether the FCC wants to do nothing, as it tried to do in 2007 or in 2016, or the FCC wants to take radical action like it tried to do in 2003 and in 2017, the broadcasters need some sort of understanding of how the rules are going to be modified. And her argument is largely about the relief that broadcasters are due as part of this process. That she brought up several times that this process has taken 17 years to get to the Supreme Court in hopes of actually getting that relief. Of course, what isn't mentioned is that the Federal Communications Commission is largely responsible for that having taken this long. In fact, the need to appeal this case to the Supreme Court, which added 3 years to the timeline itself, was a decision that the FCC made on its own instead of in October of 2019 taking its fourth loss from the Third Circuit and going back and completing the already open ownership review that is still pending from 2018. The agency decided it would be better to fight this in court. And that, when you take their two arguments together, that's what this case is largely about, is trying to get the Third Circuit out of the way. And by that, I mean having the case removed from the Third Circuit jurisdiction and sent back to a court like the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which gives the agency a little more leeway than the Third Circuit has given them in this. So that was sort of the petitioner side, sort of the people that were bringing the challenge.
Respond to those arguments, to the argument that the NAB was making, that one, minority ownership or public interest is secondary to market or competition interests. Let's take that one. I mean, how did they did they contend with that? Did they have any questions with that assertion? Because that's a fresh. I mean, not totally fresh, but it's a sort of fresh one, I think.
Sure. It was kind of a mixed bag. Some of the justices seem to think that the FCC had actually done this, but can't really get around some of the precedent that makes this more complicated. There's a case involving construction that did away with some of the FCC's abilities to do preferential programs.
Right,
for lack of a better way of explaining.
The construction that you're referring to is the federal contracts, right? That hiring,
yeah, it was
hiring the preferences for minority-owned businesses.
Right. The case is Adiran Constructors versus Pena, and what it did is it overturned a decision of the Supreme Court from earlier on that allowed the FCC to do sort of preferential programs like that. That decision was called Metro, and it allowed the FCC to have things like a distress sale policy and tax benefits for minority owners to give them some enhancements in comparative situations. So when that went away, that complicated what the FCC has been trying to do ever since. And the FCC is basically using that complication to justify not doing any work. So the justices were less skeptical that the FCC hadn't done the work, but they were kind of skeptical that the Third Circuit isn't the correct continuing venue for this. It was hard to get a read, but they're at least interested in that question. And to be fair, in 17 years is a long time for a resolution on an issue like this. But part of that is that the FCC still hasn't done what the court told it to do in 2004, right? That's not Prometheus's fault. It's not the Third Circuit's fault. It's the FCC's fault. And at least a few of the justices seem very skeptical on that point. And there's a larger judicial review issue there that comes up. The usual suspects, Justice Kavanaugh, Justice Gorsuch, they had some questions on that. Justice Alito asked a question about that as well. But it wasn't quite a centerpiece.
Trying to get at whether, again, trying to address whether the Third Circuit is the right venue. What were they or whether it should be properly moved to the D.C. Circuit? That's what basically their questions were.
Well, or to end Prometheus as the line of cases, let the FCC make a decision and then start over with the judicial review process, which is what the NAB has been arguing for a couple of years now.
So just toss out the D.C. Circuit's decision.
Everything right. That's been done to this point, basically press the reset button on it and then try again. Right. That can't get past what we've done. The past is the past. Let us start over and then we'll try again in a potentially more friendly venue. And you could see some of the justices, or you could at least from their questions, you could tell they were kind of wrestling with that, whether or not that was the right idea. I think conceptually they think it's the right idea, but the facts of this case sort of complicate that.
Thank you.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
Hello, I am here with Sarah McGatney. She's the Outreach Program Director of Domestic Violence Services at Unity House. Welcome, Sarah. How are you today?
Hello, I'm great. Thank you so much for having me on.
Domestic violence does not always look like we think it does. Can you please tell the different ways in which it manifests?
Absolutely. The first thing people think of when they think of domestic violence is physical abuse, but oftentimes scarier than the physical abuse can be the other types of abuse that go along with domestic violence. Emotional abuse, which would be putting people down, making them feel bad about themselves, calling them names, or gaslighting. That's also considered emotional abuse. It could be economic abuse, which right now, we're in a time of such economic uncertainty for so many people and families that economic abuse can be even more detrimental. So like preventing someone from going to work, forcing them to ask for money, giving an allowance, taking their money, not allowing them to know what the status of the family income is even. There is coercion and threats. That's really scary. So coercion is really hard for people to understand who don't work in this field every day and kind of understand what domestic violence is and how it psychologically it affects somebody and how trauma can take such a toll on someone mentally. But coercion is the creation of a fear that's maybe not there or real, but creating it and making somebody so afraid of that thing that they're willing to do just about anything. Using coercion or threats, actually carrying out threats can be a real thing. The other thing perpetrators will threaten to do often, which I tell my victims, this is the most dangerous thing when they say this, red flag, is threatening to kill themselves. Because if they're willing to take their own life, statistically speaking, they're going to take yours before they carry out that threat. Big, big red flag warning sign. The other thing that's interesting is religious abuse. So abusing someone through religion. We see a lot of minimizing, denying, blaming, using children or pets. Abusing pets is another big one we see to get to a victim. Withholding food from pets, hurting pets, neglecting them, and telling the victim if they don't do what the perpetrator wants them to do, that they're going to continue to hurt the pets. And we know that 86% of victims entering shelters reported that their pets were injured, permanently disabled, or killed due to the abuse. So there's so many different things that factor into domestic violence. So many different ways victims can be abused. They can be abused through technology and online. They can be stalked. Stalking is a predictor of lethality. So there have been perpetrators who have never actually physically hit their victim before, but only stalked them and killed them. So that's a predictor of lethality. So it's so important we know these other different ways that domestic violence manifests other than kind of what you normally think. And knowing that all of these things are rooted and power and control. So I really try to talk to my victims about that. Jealousy is not, you know, it's the jealousy, the hitting, the physical abuse, the emotional abuse. This isn't because somebody loves you so much. This is because they're trying to gain power and control over you.
How domestic violence impacts LGBTQI and also the immigrant individuals?
Absolutely. There are different tactics that go along with these populations. So I would consider the LGBTQAI population and our immigrant, our new Americans, our undocumented victims, specialty populations that are at a higher risk for more intensified, more lethal domestic violence. Because a huge factor of domestic violence, the perpetrators will isolate victims. They isolate them. They want them alone. They don't want them to be able to ask for help. These populations are likely already isolated and part of smaller communities. When I look at my immigrant populations, right, my new Americans or undocumented, who they have very tight, close-knit relationships with those who they culturally identify with, right? But when your perpetrator is part of that group of people, it's really hard to ask those people for help. And they're further isolated because obviously, you know, it makes a lot of sense because of all the historical trauma and things that have happened to these populations. There's not a lot of trust in the system, and there's not a lot of trust asking for help. I know, particularly with my undocumented victims, they're really scared and distrustful of the system. And there's reasons that they are. It's not without reason, but I really want them to know that we're a safe haven, right? And for, I have LGBTQAI plus victims, again, less likely to report. They may have already been discriminated against by their families, saying things about them coming out or being part of that population. And then to ask for help on top of that and to say, well, now I'm in a relationship that you already disapprove of, but now it's unhealthy and I need help. There's a lot of blaming themselves and a lot of fear of reporting. So that's what makes it even more dangerous, because that fear of reporting allows things to escalate and allows those perpetrators to know that they have complete control over those victims. And we know that trans women are at some of the highest rates for violence. They're at huge rates for lethality in relationships and not being able to seek help.
How will they be able to reach out in these specific situations?
There are a couple like quick tips I can give that I say, you know, if they're not working from home, being at work is a safe place that they may be able to access the hotline, that they may be able to access services. All of our services are open to all of these populations. They're open to everyone. It's all free of charge. We have two attorneys on staff that provide legal services, complete with the family court system, immigration, with different benefits, with divorces, with child support, all these things. We provide legal services, but all of our services are free of charge. Therapeutic services, safety services, transportation. If they can get to a way to call the hotline, I will get them transportation. They just have to get a hold of the hotline to come up with a plan. The best way to do that is probably, again, if they're working, it's good to be able to go to work and access it there. But if they are maybe not working and they go to the grocery store, for instance, just going to the bathroom, sneaking in the bathroom and trying to get a phone call might be a good way to access it.
COVID-19 affected the people that live with the threat of domestic violence. So given the situation that we're in, how can we create safe spaces for everyone? How do you think this can be accomplished?
Yeah, because what happened when COVID-19 happened is that victims became even more isolated. They're stuck at homes with their perpetrators. They're stuck in a dangerous situation. It's supposed to be safe for us staying at home, right? Safe from the pandemic, safe from getting COVID, keeping other people safe. But for these victims, it's extremely unsafe for them at home as it pertains to their domestic violence. So it's kind of a catch-22. It also eliminated that we're going to appointments, like less doctor's appointments, less routine appointments where victims would normally be able to seek help alone or being alone. So what we can do as a community to try to create safe spaces for everyone is, again, put information that's accessible, like our hotline, any way to access our services. We have a text hotline. We have a regular hotline as well. Put that in a safe location, like a bathroom, for everybody to do that. Everybody has to do something now because the victims are so isolated. So grocery stores, sticking up that in their bathrooms, you know, great option. The other thing we can do as neighbors is really important that if you're feeling something in your gut, something is wrong and you know it's severe enough that you can't step in, please call the police. You don't have to give your name. Don't think someone else is going to do it, because that's what happens. We have this bystander effect where everyone in the apartment building or everyone in the neighborhood hears something horrific happening and they kind of close their blinds and they don't call the police because they think, well, someone else will do it. I don't want to get involved. You know when it's serious enough that the police need to be involved. Trust your gut. The other thing you can do is if you see someone who you hear is being victimized, that's a neighbor you suspect is being victimized, offer them a hotline number, offer them access to your phone if they need to call it. You see them in the laundry room, if you have a shared laundry room, on the street, pulling out their car. Just do it in a really safe way, right? Because it's not safe to go up and intervene in an active domestic violence situation. That is actually quite the contrary, very dangerous. But when you see the victim alone and have access to them, asking if someone's okay could save their life. It seems like it could be embarrassing and they could say something to you like, leave me alone, mind your business. But I feel like it's really worth getting that response that may be a little embarrassing to you and saving somebody's life, because you may get a response that where you can save someone's life.
And what kind of legal protections are in place for people living with the threat of domestic violence?
There are some legal protections in place for victims living in domestic violence situations. So victims can seek orders of protection through family court. So there never has to be a conviction. They never have to file a police report. They can get emergency orders of protection for them and their children. They can get emergency custody orders through their local family court. And we help facilitate those. Those are all done virtually now. They can happen within a few hours. That's one of the legal protections that we help victims with. The other thing that we can help them with is obtaining benefits and entitlements. They can get some like emergency food stamps. They can get emergency first month's rent and security to move into a safe place. So those are a couple of the things that we help with.
And is there is any policies that you would like to see put in place, you personally?
Personally, absolutely. So I go to lobby day every year at the Capitol and lobby for different things for domestic violence victims. And what I lobby for year after year that breaks my heart that it never gets passed is locally and even regionally, we have these things called nuisance laws for landlords. So if a landlord gets too many police calls to their building, they get a fine. It's put in place to really people calling the police on their neighbors several times or different things. There are things that it's put in place to help with. However, there's nothing cut out that says that this is all good and well, but it doesn't apply to domestic violence victims. So what happens is domestic violence victims call the police a couple times and then their landlords say, if you call the police one more time, I'm going to evict you. And either they start living in a really unsafe situation and stop calling for help, or they end up homeless because they got evicted, all because they called for help because they were being abused. And so I would love to just see those kind of go away, or us to look at them a little more and have different things carve out in them that where like this all applies, but it doesn't apply if the victim is calling for domestic violence. Because as I'm sure you know, if you have an eviction on your record, it is really hard to, again, attain safe housing. And for victims of domestic violence, I have a shelter, a domestic violence shelter. It houses 33 people and it is full. I have a very high rate of homelessness in domestic violence victims. And that's just one of the reasons.
If there's anything that you would like to say to a person who potentially be in a domestic violence and might be listening right now.
Yeah, I would just like them to know that it can be more dangerous when a victim is leaving a domestic violence situation. It can become lethal. So I want them to take care when leaving. Please call our hotline for help. Let's come up with a safe plan for you to leave so nothing lethal or dangerous happens and we can get you out in the safest way possible. There is help out there. We help everybody. Our shelter accepts men, women, children, everyone LGBTQ+. Does not matter. The only requirement is that you just have to be a victim of domestic violence and seeking shelter. We have a safe place for you to go. You don't need to stay in this unsafe situation you're in, but let us help get you out of it so we can do it in a safe way.
And can you please provide the hotline number to call for domestic violence and your website info?
Our hotline number is 518-272-2370. That's accessible 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, holidays. That line is always picked up. And you can find us online at unityhouseny.org. You can access all of our services online as well.
Sarah, thank you so much for the work that you're doing in the community, and thank you for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you.
It's WGXC 90.7 FM.
Right.
Accra.
Keep going.
Hudson, Catskill, Phoenicia, and lots of other places.
That's an interesting addition.
And Valencia.
And
or
Valencia.
As they usually call it when you first land in Columbia County.
Valati.
Valati.
Very well done. Did you mention the online way
and
to use?
Online at WGXC.org.
Yes.
Tune in WGXC's new Sunday morning schedule with the Reverend Kim Singletary and There's a Bright Side Somewhere every morning, every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. That's followed by the teens from Hudson talking about books they've read on Bound by Books after the local news at 9 a.m. And at 10 a.m., there's more teens. The Catskill kids from Clubhouse Radio are on at 10 a.m. with lots of music and talk on your community radio station, WGXC.org, 90.7 FM.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Mid-Hudson Cable, serving Columbia, Greene, and Southern Albany counties with digital cable, high-speed internet, and cable phone services for homes and businesses since 1971. Mid-Hudson Cable, all the right connections on the web at mhcable.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of John and Susan from Hudson. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast, February the 5th, 2021. I'm Mike Clifford. Following Donald Trump's defeat at the polls last year, Republicans in the Arizona legislature began a flurry of bills that could make it harder for some people to vote.
The legislation would require mail-in ballots to be notarized or allow voters to receive ballots by mail, but require they be dropped off at a polling station. Other bills would scrub early voting lists and limit voter registration drives. Irene Franco Rubio with the group Our Voice, Our Vote Arizona says GOP lawmakers aren't trying to hide their intentions.
This isn't a matter of knowing if voter suppression is right or wrong. We know it's wrong, and we know that certain communities are being targeted. So we, as an organization, just want to empower our community members to recognize the power that they have and to make their voices heard.
Sponsors of the election bills say they were filed in response to accusations of widespread voter fraud in the 2020 election, although no credible evidence has surfaced to substantiate those claims. Mark Richardson reporting.
Meantime, the U.S. House voted Thursday to remove Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene from her committee assignments, that after the GOP leadership failed to punish the freshman congresswoman's embrace of bizarre conspiracy theories and endorsement of violence against Democrats. That from Yahoo News. They report the resolution to strip Greene from her seats on the Budget and Education and Labor Committees passed by a vote of 230 to 199, with 11 House Republicans joining Democrats in voting for Greene's removal. Yahoo notes in a fiery speech on the House floor shortly before the vote, Majority Leader Steny Hoyer excoriated Republican leadership for ignoring Greene's incendiary rhetoric. And as talks ramp up on another federal COVID relief package, Minnesota groups point out some families in poverty are still falling through the cracks, and they want to see a state-level stimulus payment for them.
Many levels of government have responded to the pandemic crisis by increasing access to basic needs. But Jessica Webster with Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid says not everyone gets approved for unemployment or has transportation to pick up free school meals. That's where the Minnesota Family Investment Program comes in. MFIP provides monthly cash payments to families who qualify, and Webster says right now it's the last sliver of hope for some households.
We have a parent who's a single dad who has one child but is also the guardian of his younger brother who lost work at a grocery store. and hasn't had any income since then, and COVID is really hurting those employment prospects.
Governor Tim Walz proposes a one-time extra payment of $750 through MFIP, but Republicans in the legislature recently balked at a similar idea, saying people not in the program would be left out despite their struggles. I'm Mike Moen.
This is PMS. Florida's LGBTQ community is more fully protected under state law against discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity in employment, housing, and public accommodation.
On Thursday, the Florida Commission on Human Relations, which enforces civil rights laws in the state, issued a notice that it will adhere to the U.S. Supreme Court's June ruling in Bostock versus Clayton County, a Georgia case prohibiting discrimination based on sexual orientation. Nadine Smith with the group Equality Florida says the statewide protections make this a monumental victory.
At the local level, for example, more than 60% of the population of Florida is protected by local ordinances that preceded the Supreme Court decision. That meant 40% of our state had no local laws, and the clarity that they could go and file a discrimination complaint has not been there until now.
I'm Tramell Gomes.
And New Mexico Representative Deb Holland's nomination to lead the U.S. Interior Department is historic for Native Americans.
As a tribal citizen of the Pueblo of Laguna, she would be the first Native American cabinet secretary. Shelley Fiant, chair of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribes in western Montana, says the nomination also is important for the divided country. She says Holland has proved she can be bipartisan and will bring her experience as a Native American woman to the position.
She has that holistic worldview of what the people and the land and the government really need and those changes that can come about when we do reach across the aisle.
She helped pass public lands legislation, including the Great American Outdoors Act and America's Conservation Enhancement Act. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Finally, Nadia Romligon tells us several major North Carolina growers have agreed to compensate a group of seasonal farm workers for stolen wages.
O.J. Smith Farms, Reynolds American, and national nursery chain Greenleaf all relied on a farm labor contractor who lied to workers, withheld pay, and didn't reimburse travel expenses. The lawsuit was filed by 18 members of the Farm Labor Organizing Committee. Plaintiff Jorge Bautista arrived in the state in 2019 with the promise of work. Through a translator, he said he wasn't reimbursed for his travel, was forced to purchase poor quality food, and was misled about the amount of work available.
That is the reason you go there, to work, and well, there wasn't. And that's why we decided to start the fight, to improve this whole situation.
The president of the Farm Labor Organizing Committee says he is committed to helping the more than 200 North Carolina workers who were wage theft victims collect the money owed to them. This is Mike Clifford, and thank you for wrapping up your week with Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
From the WGXC Newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. I'm Philip Grant. Andrea Mako is reporting for Porcupine Soup. The Cairo Town Board Wednesday, February 3rd, approved two resolutions intended to protect the prehistoric forest located behind the town highway garage. The fossil forest dates back 387 million years, and according to experts, it is the oldest in the world. The first resolution approved by the board gave the town authority to move forward with a feasibility study to pursue grants for the conservancy of the forest. The second measure gives the go-ahead for the town to establish a non-profit organization charged with preserving and protecting the site. Town Supervisor John Coyne pointed out there are more funding options available to not-for-profit organizations than municipalities. Meetings were recently held that included representatives from the town of Cairo, the New York State Museum, and Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties. The extensive root system of 387 million-year-old trees were discovered by researchers in 2019 as they sifted through fossil soils in a quarry behind the Cairo Highway Department.
The team, led by scientists at Binghamton University and New York State Museum and Cardiff University, has mapped more than 3,000 square meters of the forest. Their investigation showed the extensive network of trees would have spread from New York all the way to Pennsylvania and beyond. Researchers also theorized the forest was eventually wiped out by a flood due to the presence of fish fossils that were also visible on the surface of the quarry. And you can read more about this story in Porcupine Soup. Robert Gabin is reporting for the Times Union. The online monthly meeting of a coalition of Albany neighborhood groups was interrupted by a, and I quote, very disgraceful and unfortunate, end quote, torrent of hate the evening of Wednesday, February the 3rd. The intrusion interrupted the Zoom meeting of the Council of Albany Neighborhood Associations, or CANA, according to Zachary Simpson, chairman of the network that was founded in 1976. Simpson said in a message on Facebook and in email, and I quote, "We fell victim to a Zoom bombing incident where our presentations for African American History Month were interrupted with extremely offensive language and content," end quote. Simpson said Beverly Bardaquez, president of Rap Road Historical Association, was in the middle of her presentation when multiple hackers shouted racist slurs, played music with racist elements, and scrawled slurs on a white screen and a vulgar picture. Last June, the African American Cultural Center of the Capital Region's location at Madison Avenue and South Pearl Street fell victim to an attack. One or more intruders tossed rocks and a brick to smash the building's windows, picked its lock from the outside, stole items, and wrote the words, and I quote, "I hate you," end quote, inside. Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan put out a statement concerning the online attack, saying it was, and I quote, "unleashed by bigoted cowards," end quote. She went on to say, and I quote, "unfortunately, this is a sad reminder that bigots and white supremacists live among us. I ask our residents to join me in condemning this heinous act," end quote. Simpson apologized to members of the two organizations and the attendees. He said, and I quote, "I have been conducting Zoom meetings for almost a year now and never anticipated something like this occurring at a CANA meeting," end quote. Simpson said that more than 70 people were in attendance. Officer Steve Smith, a spokesman for Albany Police, said the department is looking into the incident. And you can read the full story in the Times Union. Nick Reisman is reporting for State of Politics. The state of New York will begin to vaccinate older people incarcerated in the state's prison system, officials announced on February 4th, hours after advocates filed a lawsuit. The move applies to those who are age 65 and older, which is consistent with the general population statewide that qualifies for the vaccine at this point. Senator Gustavo Rivera applauded the move, pointing out the decision was prudent given that prisons have become virus hotspots. Corrections officers and staff who come and go from the facilities have also had high rates of infection as well. The decision is a victory for advocates who have pushed state officials to begin vaccinations as they also seek the release of those people considered vulnerable to the virus. Teresa Grady, a community leader of the Release Aging People in Prison campaign, said providing access to the vaccine for older people is a good first step, but more needs to be done. And I quote, "Because of decades of mistrust with prison health care and health care more generally in communities of color, there must be a robust plan for the state health department or some other health agency that isn't doses to distribute, administer, and provide state-of-the-art education associated with the vaccine and COVID-19, end quote. Read the full story at NewYorkStateOfPolitics.com. And that wraps up the WGXC News Update. For local weather reports, public meetings, community information, or COVID-19 updates, visit our website at WGXC.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a nice weekend.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Friday, February 5th. We got 26 in Wemple and 29 in Ankrum this morning, and temperatures are pretty even across the board, even up on the mountain. Those will rise to a high of 38 at 2 p.m. And that's going to turn the light morning snow into rain that will finish by 4 p.m. A half inch of accumulation is expected. Overnight temperatures fall to 22 at dawn tomorrow. Saturday will be dry with a light breeze and a high of 34. Sunday, an inch of snow is expected to fall through the day. The high will be 33. Today's tide schedule is low at 3:08 a.m., high at 8:57 a.m., low again at 4 p.m., and high again at 9:19 p.m. Sunset today will be at 5 p.m., and sunrise tomorrow will be at 7 a.m. Those are all on the dot. Looking way up, we are expecting the Earth to pass through the heliospheric current sheet and could trigger magnetic storms late tomorrow. Solar wind speed is currently 422 kilometers per second at 3.7 protons per milliliter. The 24-hour predicted KP index is 3, quiet. The current sunspot number is 0. And this has been the Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
You're listening to Wireless Reconnaissance, Broadcast Surveillance, Transmission Art, and more Saturdays on WGXC 90.7 FM Creative Community Radio.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin direct via satellite from our on-the-spot task force.
No sports, no rock, no information for mindless chatter. We're your station.
Stand by for news.
News on the mark.
Newsroom in New York.
You have tuned in Turn on the News, the weekly newscast from the radio network, with all the radio coverage of the radio. Now with computerized news readers, with fewer meddling humans, and more aggregated reporting and automated music. Tune in Turn on the News each week for the latest news, radio art, and more from our robot reporters, making sure you hear both sides, good and evil, every time you turn on the news.
On the WKRP teletype, monster lizard ravages East Coast. Officials say this lizard, the worst since 78, has devastated transportation, disrupted communications, and left many hundreds homeless.
Monster lizard?
The wire service never lies.
Les, the B is out on the printer. It's monster blizzard.
Turning to the local scene.
Put your little hand in mine.
Nice going, boys. You're playing yesterday's tape.
It's going to be cold, it's going to be gray, and it's going to last you for the rest of your life.
Groundhog Day, everybody, like every other day since March 12th. But today is actual Groundhog Day, which, for no apparent reason, America seeks weather prophecy from meteorological prognosticator Punxsutawney Phil. It's been a rough run since last Groundhog Day, so we all had our fingers crossed for some promising rodent forecasting from Phil and his council of top-hatted hog fondlers. But sadly, our hopes for spring were spurned because Phil saw his shadow, which means there will be six more weeks of winter. For the love of God, Phil! I can't take it. I don't want to be stuck inside six more weeks staring at snow outside the window. I am ready to be stuck inside staring at rain outside the window.
Pennsylvania groundhog Punxsutawney Phil today saw his shadow, which in COVID times means six more weeks of February.
And the timing of this event, looking back, is very suspicious. Think about this. On February 2nd of last year, we had zero reported deaths from COVID. Wasn't even the thing. Most of the news that day was about the Super Bowl. But then, a month and a half later, the whole country was on lockdown. Exactly 6 weeks to the day after Groundhog Day, look what happened. But who could have known? Who on February 2nd, 2020 could possibly predict what would happen in 6 weeks? That damn groundhog, that's who. And he didn't tell us. Maybe the virus comes from groundhogs.
But there is a chance that Phil's not giving us the straight dope here. You see, stick with me. In 2020, Phil predicted an early spring, but as the AP pointed out, he didn't say anything about a pandemic. Wait a second. Is the Associated Press implying that America's preeminent magical woodchuck is not a board-certified epidemiologist? I hope they can back that up with something. The ceremony was a little different this year. Due to the pandemic, instead of any groundhog groupies, the audience was packed with cardboard cutouts. Well, then that means there were no proper witnesses. I demand a hand recount of the groundhog. Stop the shadow! Storm Gobbler's Knob!
Come on, everybody! Clap your hands! Ah, you're looking good! I'm gonna sing my song. It won't take long. We're gonna do the business, and it goes like this! Come on, let's get things again! Like we did last summer! Yeah, let's get things again! Like we did last year! Do you remember when things were really humming? Yeah!
I have seen my shadow, and I predict we're going to have at least two more weeks of impeachment, because this morning, House Democrats released their trial brief, which argues the former president is singularly responsible for the violence and destruction that unfolded in our seat of government on January 6th as he summoned a mob to Washington, exhorted them into a frenzy, and aimed them like a loaded cannon down Pennsylvania Avenue. Now, the brief opens with a simple timeline of the facts. The president refuses to accept the results of the 2020 election. The president incites insurrectionists to attack the Capitol. Insurrectionists incited by the president attack the Capitol. The president is derelict of duty during the attack. Okay, that checks out. He is a derelict, and they smeared the Capitol with duty. This afternoon, the former president's lawyers put out their official response to the Democrats' impeachment charges, and they proved themselves top legal minds by addressing the filing to members of the United States Senate. Yes, the United States Senate, both Republicans and Democrats. United States. The disgraced former president's team argued that he cannot be convicted by the Senate because he is no longer in office. So, okay, once you leave a job, you're immune from prosecution. Cannibalism. Nice try, Your Honor, but I don't even work at White Castle anymore. But the president's defenders go beyond legal arguments. They don't even want there to be a trial. Take impeachment lawyer David Schoen. House managers like Eric Swalwell have said that they're going to use news footage of the riot to prove their case. Schoen believes that's a bad idea for America.
We know now, apparently, that Mr. Swalwell and the other managers tend to show videotapes of the riots and people calling in, people being hurt, police officers talking. Why does the country need that now? We need to heal now. We need to move forward.
Yes, healing comes from not providing any evidence. As it says in the Hippocratic Oath, first, snitches get stitches. Schoen's not the only one who wants an evidence-free trial. So does South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham. Lindsey was on the Fox News, and he had a warning for House impeachment managers.
To my Democratic colleagues, if you vote to call one witness, none were called in the House, get ready for a long trial. But if you open up that can of worms, we'll want the FBI to come in and tell us about how people actually pre-planned these attacks and what happened with the security footprint at the Capitol. You open up Pandora's box if you call one witness.
That's true. That's true, Lindsey. Yes, it is a slippery slope to information. You can always tell who the good guys are. They're the ones saying, make sure there are no witnesses. Graham's not worried about tearing the country apart. He's worried about the split in the Republican Party. You see, there's this little fringe group in the party who believes it's wrong to attack the Capitol building. And they're focusing their anger on Georgia representative and woman Zoom calling from the outhouse, Marjorie Taylor Greene. Greene's a public backer of QAnon. She's claimed that mass shootings, including school shootings, were staged, and she has supported the execution of Democratic leaders, so a moderate Republican.
Tonight, growing outrage at newly elected Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene. The noted conspiracy theorist and ardent Trump supporter from Georgia is facing calls to resign and a long-shot bid to expel her from Congress after a review of her social media found in 2018 and 19 she repeatedly indicated support for executing prominent Democrats, including Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
In a widely shared video from 2019, Greene declaring Pelosi a traitor, implying she should be executed.
It's a crime punishable by death, is what treason is. Nancy Pelosi is guilty of treason.
She's called for the hanging of Barack Obama. She's called for the hanging of Hillary Clinton.
Right now, they're trying to expel me from Congress. Yep, they don't like a lot of the things I say and do. It's a witch hunt.
Yeah, they don't like the things you said because you called for their execution. They're not looking for a witch hunt. They're looking to stay alive. I mean, people, what kind of psychopath calls for the execution of America's leaders on Facebook? I mean, at least if you did it on Snapchat, it would be harder to find. Also, the puppy nose makes you seem less crazy. So who is this person that might get expelled from Congress after less than a month? Well, let's get to know her. Meet Marjorie Taylor Greene. In Congress, she represents Georgia's 14th district, right outside Atlanta. And in life, she represents some views right outside of reality.
Marjorie Taylor Greene, she has in the past promoted that QAnon conspiracy theory.
Q is a patriot. We know that for sure. But we do not know who Q is. People believe that Q is someone